IFPRI Policy Seminar, Input Subsidy Programs in Developing Countries. What works, what doesn't, and why? Held on April 18, 2013 in Washington, D.C. Speaker, Thomas Jane, from Michigan State University.
Thank you kindly, Schengen. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for your warm welcome. The fact that Schengen reminded me that we were looking at similar issues 20 years ago or so makes me realize how old we're getting, that this topic of input subsidy programs is so intractable. I can't imagine how Derek Byerly must feel. He's probably been through this for four decades. Anyway, once again, it's a pleasure. So, let me start out by saying what I'm here to try to do over the next 10-15 minutes. We just concluded, as Schengen mentioned, a workshop for the past 2 days on input subsidy programs in Africa. There were probably 30-35 people there in total, and one of our goals was to try to synthesize the available evidence. And I think that you will agree, and others will agree, that there's been quite a bit of useful empirical evidence added in the last few years. So we're pleased to be in a position to report that to you. I'd also like to tell you about a survey that we took of participants, which I think you'll find interesting. So let me just start out by saying that, as you probably know, 10 years ago, input subsidy programs were pretty much in disfavor. There might have been one or two programs in sub-Saharan Africa, but really not many. But over the course of the past 10 years, subsidy programs have now scaled up to about $2 billion per year in expenditures. And our preliminary estimates are that these programs take up roughly 30% of agricultural budgets across the continent. So quite a large share increase in program expenditure. So how did we get to where we are today, you know, over the last 10 years? So the boom and the bust to boom cycle can be explained by about five things. The first one is HIPC initiative. This is the heavily indebted poor countries. 33 of them were in Africa. Debt forgiveness that was kind of phased in somewhere in the early 2000s really did relieve the budget constraint that had been a severe impediment to the implementation of these programs in the past. The second and related one was the shift in the way that aid donors provided assistance from conditionality agreements, which were quite heavy-handed in some ways, to budget support, where basket funding would go straight into the treasury and governments were at more liberty to allocate their funds in ways without constraints from external pressure. The third factor that we identified had to do with the special case of Malawi. Malawi was really a test case. And we spent quite a bit of time on Tuesday going over this program. There were three presentations by African presenters on the Malawi miracle. That quotation, by the way, is from the New York Times article of 2007, where they became a food exporter by implementing these programs. I must say that if the facts be straight, Malawi has imported food for the last 5 years. It's not a food exporter, although that probably isn't the first time that the New York Times got it wrong on that case. The fourth factor would be the rise in global food prices since 2007. This specter of high food prices, the potential to not be able to get food from world markets, really did naturally push many governments in the world to seek self-sufficiency. Input subsidy programs are certainly a powerful way to achieve that. So that's the fourth factor. And then the fifth one, which is kind of related to the second one, is that the World Bank, going from in the early 2000s from not being, entirely resistant to subsidy programs, but certainly wanting to keep them quite small, has actually turned around and is now helping to finance many of these programs. So those are the five factors that we think are kind of driving where we got to now in 2013 over the past years. So there were four questions that we put to participants at this workshop yesterday, and I'd like to share with you what the results of them were. The first question was, is there a role for input subsidy programs in sub-Saharan Africa, true or false? And the second one was, do you feel that input subsidy programs are fairly good the way they are? They need small tweaks in program implementation, or do they need major reforms, or should they simply be discontinued? So here's the results. On the first one, almost 70% of the participants felt like there was a valid role for input subsidy programs. And I'd like to admit that I'm one of those 69%. I sometimes get called a skeptic of subsidy programs, but I think there certainly is a role for them. Number two, the results here were showing that even though most people did agree that there was a role for these programs, they really needed quite significant reforms in order to make them viable. The third question that was asked was, what should be the primary rationale for subsidy programs? And the results show that there's wide views. Over a quarter felt like increasing food supplies was the main rationale. Poverty reduction was less. And then this notion of kickstarting dynamic growth processes was probably the majority. And then the last and final question that we canvassed participants are, should these programs be scaled up in terms of expenditure? Are they about at the right level of expenditure, or should they be downsized? And on that one, the results were fairly decisive that there is a role for them, but they should be downsized. So currently 30% of budget allocations seems to be more than most participants felt was justified. So if I can give you my own subjective consensus of the workshop, it's that there are four things. Number one is that spending a large fraction of agricultural budgets on these input subsidy programs may not be the most effective way to promote the welfare of its citizens, but it certainly is a highly demonstrable way to support citizens. It's one that's visible. It's one where African leaders can point to and say, we're doing tangible things here to promote the livelihood of our rural citizens. We're trying to increase food supplies, so forth. The second point is that they certainly are a powerful tool for increasing food production in one season. If the size of the subsidy is large enough, and if it rains, there's going to be a production response. But if they account for too large a share of agricultural spending, then we're in trouble, because it tends to crowd out other very important expenditures that are needed for long-term development and sustainable development. And the last point that I think some of the other speakers are likely to take up too, is that we want to move to a system where input use and intensification is not really being fueled simply by subsidized input prices, but to move to a system of profitable input use, where the foundation for rural economic growth is based on sustainable economics, where it's profitable, where there's effective demand, and where there's a system in place to meet that demand. And there are two or three things that are decisive to achieve that kind of environment. One of them is to get crop response rates up. The profitability of using fertilizer is very much related to the response rate of grain to fertilizer. And on this point, I wanted to put up a graph. I can't move from this podium, so I'll have to point. This comes from Zambia. And it comes from the most productive region of Zambia in terms of maize production, Natural Region 2A, for those of you who might be familiar with that country. And farmers in this area, if there's anywhere where fertilizer response should be high and where fertilizer should be economically profitable, it would be here. The marginal product, which is along the x-axis here, is the kilograms of maize production from one kilogram of nitrogen nutrient use. And just by contrast, in much of Asia, the response rates are in the range of 40 to 50. In the United States, they're similar. The median response rate in this very productive area of Zambia was 16 kilograms of maize per kilogram of nitrogen. And you can see that about a third of those farmers received response rates that are much lower than that, over here on the left-hand side of the distribution. We computed that if farmers in the bottom half of the distribution of crop response were simply able to achieve the mean of 16, that would increase national maize production by 8%. So crop response rate is a major factor that influences the profitability of input use and the sort of sustainable intensification incentives. When you put all of this together, we conclude that many of these, the viability of input subsidy programs are going to depend on underlying investments in crop science, in agronomic management, better management practices, extension programs to help farmers take advantage of the technologies that are available and use them efficiently, road infrastructure, and the like. So it becomes an issue of how to properly balance the composition of public spending in order to get the biggest bang for its buck. And input subsidy programs may have a role in the mix as long as these other investments are successful in increasing the viability of these programs. So there's complementarity that we should be taking advantage of. However, one might question whether the current pattern of public expenditure is really achieving or even close to achieving this kind of composition that we want. FISP, this is Zambia, by the way. FISP, public expenditures take up about, FISP takes up 30% of public expenditures over the past 10 years or so in Zambia. The FRA is the maize marketing board in Zambia. So as you can see, the size of the public expenditure pie to agriculture leaves very little for these other things: seed improvements, farm extension and training programs, irrigation systems, climate change mitigation, policy analysis within the ministries, rural electrification, you know, rail, port, all of these complementary things that are necessary to ground the rural economy in sustainable, you know, productivity growth and intensification. To the extent that the subsidy programs are eating up that budget, I think that that spells for trouble. So I would like to wind up here and just say that because of political realities and because of some economic rationale, input subsidy programs are very likely to remain in the future. So, can we provide some concrete guidance about how to improve their effectiveness? And so I'm just going to focus on two things. There were probably 20 that were identified yesterday, but I'm just going to highlight two of them that we felt would have a pretty substantial effect on the benefits and costs of these programs. The first one is to have complementary public investments in agronomic research and extension programs to enable farmers to use fertilizer more efficiently. That single issue alone would do a great advantage to raising the viability of subsidy programs. The second proposal would be to reconsider targeting guidelines to achieve a more equitable impact pattern. I hope you can read this, and I'm going to take just 60 seconds to walk through this. This is a this is coming from nationally representative survey data in Zambia, where all of the farms in the country were split into farm size categories. And as you can see, about 70% of the farms in Zambia are under 2 hectares. Okay, 70% of the farms in Zambia are under 2 hectares. There are about 0.5% of the farms in Zambia that are over 10 hectares. Now let's look at how the fertilizer subsidies were allocated to those farmers. 14% of the bottom category got fertilizer subsidies, whereas over half of the farmers in the larger farm size category got fertilizer. But that's only the percentage who received. Now let's look at how much they received. On average, 24 kilograms went to the smallest farms, whereas the over 345 kilograms went to the larger farms. Now, and then just carrying this through, look at the maize surpluses that get produced. On average, three bags or 150 kilograms of maize was produced by farms in the bottom category, whereas the top farmers produced 15 tons. So you can see the remarkable distributional impacts, income distributional impacts coming from the allocation of government funding to subsidy programs. Now, one could say that it's important to target these farmers down here because they can make more productive use of fertilizer. Here's the evidence on that. When you look at the kilograms of maize per kilogram of fertilizer, you see that there really isn't any significant difference, 3.7 kilograms of maize per kilogram of fertilizer among the smallest farms, and really very little difference across farm size category. We can talk about why that result obtains in Q&A, but let me leave it at that to say that this notion that there is an equity efficiency trade-off so far seems to be pretty much of a red herring, and that by promoting and by targeting the smaller farmers, that's not having any adverse effects on efficiency. This is a well-known relationship between the sort of efficiency productivity relationship in our literature. So our second and final proposal just be reconsider targeting guidelines in a more equitable way. So, Mr. Chair, let me wind up. I have three concluding points from the last day and a half. That number one, that subsidy programs would be more effective if adequate resources were allocated to complementary public investments. So we're not saying, get rid of subsidy programs. There's a role for them, but maybe scale them back. More balanced public expenditure pattern would be more effective in promoting national policy objectives. Number three is that there are concrete steps, and I've only talked about two of them. There are many other ones that we talked about yesterday that could be implemented to increase the effectiveness of these programs in achieving their national policy objectives. And then the last and final point that I wanted to leave you with is really a question for all of you. Given that there's probably fairly wide consensus, here's the question. And I hope we can come to this later on today, is how can these messages be communicated in a non-defensive, in a way that will actually have some receptivity to them among policymakers? So, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.